The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
A lot happening, both domestically and internationally. But let's start domestically first. And the Grace report, long delayed, published yesterday. What was your reaction when you read it or read the findings?
Well, one of extreme sadness, anger, that a person, that Grace in particular, was so failed by the state in the totality of her experience, of her life experience, the absence of fundamental care and of a fundamental caring environment by the state and by the health board at the time. And that's what comes across in a very telling way. It, in many ways, that era does predate Tusla. There was no Tusla at the time. But that said, we had the Child Care Act had been passed in about 1991. There would have been various inquiries into childcare prior to what happened to Grace, and there was absolutely no excuse for it.
Now, 13.6 million euro, 8 years, and that term, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. Now, she was compensated in the interim, so there was some rectification of the state for its failures. But still, getting to the bottom of those accusations from whistleblowers of accusations of sexual abuse, 8 years in the making.
I'm on record in the Dáil last week in terms of, and I'm not making comments specific to this one because we have to accept the report itself. But you're right, it's taken 8 years. 14, close to 14 million, and probably will increase in terms of costs when full legal fees are in and so on. And, you know, we do need to fundamentally reflect on how we're doing these inquiries, the effectiveness of them, and whether there's a better way of cutting to the truth and getting to the truth earlier and much more effectively.
The trail would be fairly cold at this point after this report is now published in 2025.
And for all involved, it's far too long. In terms of those who would have been involved either in the care of Grace, Grace herself, even though Grace was not conscious aware of the fact
that
there was...
Is not even aware that an inquiry
is underway. But nonetheless, people who have been in her family and people engaging with her and so forth, the carers all involved, it is simply far too long.
Now,
we do need to reflect on this, because this is not the only inquiry that goes on for an undue length of time
and
costs an enormous amount of money.
The so-called ex-family, I mean, if you think of what they are accused of, and now, according to the Commission's findings, they can't prove. I mean, it doesn't entirely vindicate their name, because there was emotional abuse, they say. No evidence of emotional abuse, but there was physical neglect and financial abuse.
Yes, and that's what the Commission is saying. Far more serious allegations had been made, which gave rise to the commission being established. They have not been upheld, so to speak, or the language is that no evidence has been found. So that for all concern, has to be deeply unsatisfactory.
Yeah, I mean, it's just leaving it hanging there, because it says it's likely that the injuries perceived on Grace may have been self-inflicted. I mean, this is the kind of grey area. May not. Who knows?
Exactly. And that is not satisfactory, ultimately. I do think we accept, the government accepts the findings, but I think the Oireachtas and all involved in public discourse on these matters really do need a hard think as to the most effective way of getting to the truth. I heard Bernard Gloucester saying this morning, the head of the HSE, that there'd been an earlier report, I think he referred to the Divine report, which more or less came to similar conclusions.
So what were we doing for the last...
So, I mean, it would be remiss, I think, of the Dáil, generally, and the Oireachtas, not to reflect very seriously on the modality and methodology of commissions of investigation and inquiries. Now, they take an inordinate length of time. They cost millions. And there's an argument to be had for strengthening our own institutions, bodies like HEQA, Health and Safety Authority, bodies like, you know, FISRU, which is the new GSOC, a new name for GSOC and so on. We should have institutions that can get these investigations done more quickly, more effectively, and get answers more because part of the purpose of this is to improve services, make sure these type of cases do not arise again into the future.
There was a very odd moment yesterday when Norma Foley was saying, I did want the other families, because there's a total of 47 out there, there were 7 complaints really to be investigated and 40 had no real complaints against their foster care. Wanted the families to have early warning of the publication of this report, and the commission said no.
Correct.
And can you understand that?
Two things.
As an act of kindness alone.
I think, it's a fundamental principle that those, you know, in relation to which inquiries are underway or people who are involved should be notified in advance, in my personal view. And also, there is always a need for an executive summary to be written in respect of an inquiry of this size and scale. However, governments cannot interfere with any commission or cannot dictate to a commission in terms of how the commission does its
work.
But do
you understand?
And I fully understand it.
I know the rules. Yeah. But I mean, do you understand the decision from the commissioner not to allow early warning to people who have been hanging on it for years?
I do not understand that. And that's a matter for the commission to explain.
And we want an explanation, do we?
Well, look, I think it's a matter for the commission to explain why it took that particular
course. But just clarify, you want an explanation.
Well, I would appreciate one. But I think it also should inform how we establish inquiries into the future. Because number 40 is just in the job. This report, I think, came in around last July. The report is difficult to read. I think they're up to 2,000
pages. 2,000 pages.
And therefore, that in itself, for people to people need to read it, and people need to obviously assess and draw its conclusions. But it fundamentally, I think it comes back to the point. And look, Pat, at this very moment, there could be about 5 to 6 requests for more public inquiries into different aspects of life in Ireland.
You want our processes reformed.
But I think we have to really fundamentally look, is this the way to go? Because since 1998, the state has spent half a billion on inquiries. Some have been effective and some have had impactful and have led to change. But the enormity of the cost, when we still need resources for the children of today, and to make sure we resource, particularly children in very, very disadvantaged backgrounds or with significant dysfunctional backgrounds, it is arguable that some of the resources would be better spent on looking after them and the facilities.
But we also need to get to the truth, and we need to find the perpetrators of any wrongdoing and deal with them in accordance with the law.
I agree, and I think we should be able to do that more effectively using the institutions that have been established to do that in the first place.
Now, another inquiry. One that's only been recently constituted, but referring to something that happened a long time ago, the OMA bombing. And now there's been a change in terms of the cooperation offered by this state to that inquiry. Bottom line, though, the Minister for Justice, Jim O'Callaghan, will have the last word on who gets to testify and what may be said.
Yeah, but I think it's very welcome news. And in fact, as Minister for Foreign Affairs, I was working with Minister Helen McEntee at the time at the Department of Justice, and with the Northern Ireland Executive and the British government on this. And we have to do everything we possibly can to make sure that the fullest information is made available to the OMA inquiry in terms of its work. This is important on a number of fronts. And obviously there has to be protocols around that in terms of intelligence information and so forth. But the fact that a memorandum of understanding has been agreed with the chair of the tribunal and the Minister for Justice is very good progress.
Now, we've been told that senior Garda officers now retired have been advised by presumably their lawyers not to testify.
I regret that if that's the case. I think people should testify and people should cooperate, in my view, with the inquiry. I take the view that those who planted that bomb are the people who are culpable for the appalling loss of life that arose from the planting of that bomb in OMA. We all remember it. It's a day that will always be etched in our minds.
The bomb was made in the Republic.
The bomb was made in the Republic. And many people connected were pursued on different charges and on different issues.
I mean, the key issue is whether or not security forces North and South were aware that something was going on and did nothing to stop it. That's the key.
That's the key issue at stake here that's been suggested. That's why an inquiry needs to be comprehensive to deal with that assertion. And that's why it's also important, because things get said about the Republic from certain quarters. It's important that we here are very open and transparent in respect of these issues. We did initiate the Smittic inquiry, for example, way back as part of the Good Friday Agreement, and we fulfilled our obligations in that respect. So I really welcome the fact that we have been in a position to get agreement with the tribunal.
But there are still areas that might be no-go for this inquiry, for the OMA inquiry.
Potentially, I mean, that's true on the UK side as well as on the Irish side. But hopefully we can cooperate in a way that the tribunal will be able to get to the bottom of this.
Moving on to Donald Trump, we'll be talking with Scott Lucas later on about what Trump is doing to America. But, I mean, you feel you have to deal with the Trump administration irrespective of the political direction it's taking. But I'm just wondering, would we bother ever dealing with a Duterte or a Bolsonaro? I mean, we'd call them out, would we not? And now we have Donald Trump blaming Zelensky for starting the war, which is a downright lie. And we have him echoing the talking points of Vladimir Putin. I mean, what do you do with a man like that?
I think we continue to engage with the US administration. I mean, the US is still providing intelligence and support, notwithstanding all you've said, to the Ukrainian army.
But he comes out with a statement about the bombing of Sumy. It was, it was a mistake.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of gave a wry laugh when they heard that lie.
And that was a horrific bombing by Russia. And there is no evidence that Russia is truly engaging in any peace process. The sense is that Russia is endeavouring to get itself into the most advantageous position it can get itself into prior to substantive talks on a peace process.
It brings the Ukrainians who are living here. Many of those will have fled those very areas which are occupied by Russia now and which may remain after some sort of peace talk in Russia's possession. What for those people living in Ireland, what can you say to them?
Well, I think Ireland has been very welcoming and has given very significant support to Ukrainians who fled that war. It's unprecedented in terms of our own history as part of the European Union on this occasion that we've opened up essentially to about 100,000 came in. Not all are here now. It's about 80,000 who are now.
But many of them will have fled those very areas.
They will. And again, Europe, we work collectively with Europe in terms of a response to the war and also in terms of the European Union directive, which provides support to refugees from war. And the Ukrainians are that. We continue to support the Ukrainians.
How frustrating is it in Europe when you are meeting your fellow prime ministers to be dealing with Viktor Orban, who also seems to be a Putin poodle?
It's very frustrating and it's very serious in the sense that we're now in a position, for example, when it comes to Ukraine and Russia, where the 26 member states take a decision and Hungary sort of abstains. And Hungary will allow statements to be issued on behalf of the 26, not on behalf of the 27. Hungary frustrated and paralysed the European peace framework or the mechanism which was used to get support to Ukraine. That's why we've had to go on a bilateral channel. In other words, we have to provide our supports, non-lethal, to Ukraine or via other channels because the European facility has been paralysed by the lack of unanimity and Hungary being the country that is.
And there's no mechanism short of another treaty to get rid of Hungary
from
the EU.
Moment, and there's not, but I think this is coming to a very serious juncture and will eventually because it has the potential really to undermine the workings of the European Union because even and also the veto has been used in a way that it was never intended to be used. I mean, invariably, the veto was there on tax matters or matters that member states could use to protect a vital national interest. It's very clear that Hungary has used the veto for tactical reasons or strategic reasons, but not for the protection of a national interest. And that is very problematic. And that's why Germany and other countries have formed a group to look at treaty change, particularly if we're going to enlarge the European Union, bring in states from the Western Balkans, bring in Ukraine, Moldova.
Because Hungary is almost like a fifth column within the EU. I mean, it doesn't espouse the values of Europe anymore. I mean, changes to the judiciary, the media is not as free as it should be, and so on and so forth.
And there's been, you know, very negative and political attacks on LGBTI community also, and increasingly The commentary about the European Union is a way out there. I mean, it's for someone who's a member of the European Union, who benefits from the European Union, his attacks on the Commission are unacceptable.
Moving on to trade, and we know that Maros Sefcovic is involved in those trade talks. He said there will be no diminution of EU food standards. We won't be having American chlorinated chicken or hormone-fed beef. But if the deal has come to some sort of conclusion, some sprat has got to be thrown to Trump.
Yeah, I think there will be a number of issues. First of all, it's important that they get into a negotiation pathway. And I sincerely hope that Maros Sefcovic and the Commission more generally can get into that serious talks with the US administration. I mean, there's a number of issues from technology, the whole tech sector, where US feels the regulation is far too severe and that there's not a greater focus on innovation. And they feel it, whether it's correct or not, but the bottom line, we should understand that they feel it. And we've heard this loud and clear, that they feel there's a certain antipathy from the European Union towards technology companies and towards the big ones emanating from the US. So that's one issue. And the non-tariff barrier issues. Is Europe in a position to purchase more goods from America more generally? So if it's a broad, more comprehensive agreement, I think progress can be made. And you're correct, there has to be give and take in all negotiations.
I mean, Big Pharma has been talking. The CEO of Johnson & Johnson has said there will be medicine shortages if there are tariffs on pharma. And, you know, the Taoiseach has said it would be, I'm not quite quoting exactly, but it's more or less, it would be bad faith on the part of America to impose tariffs during a negotiation.
Yeah, I think I've spoken to a lot of the pharmaceutical CEOs. Clearly, it would lead to an increase in prices and it would lead to a shortage of new medicines. And there's an understanding of that, I believe, in the US administration, hence the fact that they haven't yet put tariffs on pharma.
I mean, tariffs is because of the supply chains and potential shortages. That's why it's zero at the moment.
Correct. And also, there's an investigation being announced by the administration, I think a Section 232, on national security grounds in respect of pharma. So I think there is a realization, even the initiation of that, while some see it as a precursor to tariffs, others might see it as a better and more detailed examination of the issue before jumping into making decisions that could be very detrimental to both the supply of medicines and the price of medicines, because what the administration will not want to do in the US is increase prices for Americans, and particularly elderly Americans, who will be on medication.
Now, those who are saying, look, this is all about China. Trump wants to isolate China, and this is the way he's going about it. Now, China has responded with, we're not taking your beef, we are not taking your LNG, and not alone that, we're not taking your Boeings. And they reckon over the next 20 years, 8,000 Boeings will not be bought by Chinese airlines. They've been ordered by the boss, Xi Jinping, not to take delivery of Boeings from now on. So,
And Ireland is one of the biggest buyers of Boeing through Ryanair and AerCap, has to be said. And these are the kind of arguments that we in Europe will be making to the US on a continuing basis. But your point is really, a US-China trade war in itself is hugely destabilizing. And it will be destabilizing to both countries, but also to the wider world, notwithstanding all the other tariffs on other countries. So it's very, very serious. And that's why negotiations need to happen, not just between the EU and US, but also between the US and China. Because what you've articulated there essentially is the interdependence of modern trade. It can no longer be brought back to a sort of a 19th century goods, you know.
But the Chinese are being clever. I mean, they're not taking soya from American farmers. They're not taking beef from American farmers, as I mentioned, Boeing, and LNG they're finding in Australia. So they're saying, we can find other ways. We can hurt you, and we won't suffer ourselves by the absence of these products. Europe has to be as smart.
It does, and then Europe has done a lot of preparation for these talks. But of course, I don't think either of us can get away from the mutual interdependence. Neither can China. I mean, America is a huge market for consumption of Chinese goods. So, either way, everybody loses if a trade war of this kind continues. And I think, if anything, I think Europe has to be smart in terms of how it negotiates with the US. But Europe has to press ahead very strongly, which it is, in terms of trade deals with the likes of India, for example, Indonesia, Thailand, and other countries, just like we did with Japan and Canada, which have yielded significant benefits for Irish companies. And we have to keep pivoting to that side as well, whilst trying to get a reasonable settlement with the US in terms of tariffs.
Now, there are other items on your agenda. The planning, for example, of critical infrastructure, we're coming back to domestic matters, and the fact that you've announced the Cluas, the Cork Cluas, which looks like a very ambitious project, and there's no firm date for delivery, though.
There is not, but I mean, I've spoken to Minister O'Brien about this, Dara O'Brien, and to the TII, the Transport Infrastructure Ireland, and said, look, we want this accelerated. Even the whole launch of the public consultation has moved it on somewhat because we've accelerated the timeline there in terms of getting it out. But obviously, we want the public to respond. There will be issues, obviously, as there always are. But I think it's very important in terms of because it's the fastest growing city in the country. And will continue to grow. And I think this is a very important model outside of Dublin that we can get going. And obviously we'll be looking at similar projects in Limerick and in Galway as well.
I mean, the fact that you've got Cluas, which is speed for Dublin, Cluas, which is listen in Cork, and Cluas in Galway for
Even though we talk very fast in Cork, we do listen to, you know. but just to make a point there, though, the Kent Station, the railway in Cork, has undergone a transformation on time and on budget. And there's kind of exciting things happening in Cork on public transport. Fair play to Éireann Róid Éireann, Bus Éireann and everybody involved. And this is a new chapter to that. And it's important that we get working
on it. But isn't it time that we kind of started to move those critical infrastructural projects into a different area of planning? Like On Board Planall has to do everything from the garden shed that shouldn't be there to offshore wind. And if you look at what's happening in Britain with the Universal Studios announcement, they've just announced it, and I think last year they kind of applied for it, brick upon brick next year.
Yeah,
and very quick.
It's quick, yeah, although Keir Starmer would say to me that likewise in terms of wind energy and so on, they can have similar lengthy timelines in respect of wind farms and so on. I think we do have to get it done quicker. We have reformed On Board Planall, resourced it more effectively. There is a point in what you're saying in terms of scale of projects and the prioritisation of those or the treatment of those in different sort of
you see, the board has to have expertise in so many different areas. The idea would be that if you're doing rail, there might be a body that would just check out the rail and have expertise in rail. The same for aviation, the same for wind farms, the same for solar.
Except you can't get into a kind of a silo approach either to this. There has to be a, you know, multidisciplinary approach.
But you aren't changing the rules for solar and wind, are you not?
Well, we're saying to every county council in the country, you have to play your part. There's been a move in recent times where development plans are sent up, mainly for political reasons, to say we don't want any of this. And they're constructed in such a way as to, more or less, there can never be a wind farm again. Solar is growing. The bottom line is this. Do we want to continue our dependence on fossil fuel or do we want to move to a renewable space? The only effective way Ireland can deal with climate change and give us energy dependence and ultimately cheaper energy is to go the renewable way. We've made tremendous progress on onshore wind over the last 20 years. We can do likewise on offshore, but we have to be relentless on all aspects from planning right through. We have to be relentless in our focus on getting renewables done. And wind and solar will transform the country.
Last item is Airbnbs. You know, the rules have been agreed now in Cabinet. If your town is over 10,000, you'll have restrictions on the amount of Airbnb. Now, I did the numbers about, you know, 90 days you're still allowed. If you've got a two-bedroom flat and you can let it overnight, Airbnb, say in Dublin, €200 a night, multiply that by the number of days you're allowed, it amounts to renting it for the whole year at €1,500 a month, which you've no difficulties with tenants damaging properties. If they don't pay, you can't get rid of them and the RTB. Yep. So, I mean, is this new idea fit for purpose? And will it be enforced anyway?
It will be enforced, but it's one extra measure. And in terms of a whole range of measures we're taking to prioritise housing.
I mean, who's going to be counting the 90 days?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is this. I think the planning framework will be important in this, the need to register and so on like that. It changes the approach to what we've had now, which has been essentially a free-for-all. A lot of potentially houses that could be there for the rental market have gone into the Airbnb. We need to rebalance that, particularly in our cities, And this this will be paralleled with planning changes that will, particularly in the cities and in towns over 10,000.
Yeah, but you can see the attractions for landlords going into the Airbnb business because it's cleaner. And if the people damage it, they have the credit card details, they get paid for the damage. It's clean. Whereas the RTB, you might never get the money that you're owed. The damage will never be paid for.
I've been arguing this point that the experience of some, although the number of landlords, according to the RTB, is growing, but nonetheless, not at the rate that we need. And some are leaving because of the reasons that you've outlined, because of the difficulties in getting redress or getting issues resolved quickly and efficiently. On the other hand, we have to move on a number of fronts to get more houses available for rent and for the rental market. And that's the objective here. It's not on its own. It's not going to sort it all out on its own as a measure, but it's one of a number of measures.
Taoiseach Micheál Martin, thank you very much for joining us in studio.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.